Ron Pattinson joins me to discuss British beer brewing in World War II. This is Beersmith Podcast number 294.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 294, and it's early December 2023. Ron Pattinson joins me to discuss British beer brewing in World War II. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click on that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical beer brewing and runs a blog called Shut Up About Barclay Perkins at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Ron, it's great to have you on the show again. How are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you. Always nice to have a chat.
Yeah, you said it's cold in Amsterdam today, I guess, yeah?
Yeah, well, not that bad. It's not like it's below freezing or anything, but chilly hey. For here.
We were talking before the show about the castle in the background there on the video.
Yeah, this is the castle in my hometown, Newark-on-Trent, so.
Awesome. But you've been in Amsterdam for many, many years now.
Yeah, I've been here since the late 80s.
Wow.
So, well, a long time.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show. What projects have you been working on lately? I know I think you just finished up, finalized, I guess, the World War II book this year, but have you been working on other projects as well?
Yeah, well, I also wrote a book on the history of London Stout this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which also came out in June. Then I had the book on World War II, and I've also done a book of my travel stuff came out as well this year. So
interesting. Tell me, obviously we talked about stouts in one of the previous episodes, but tell me about your travel book.
The travel book, that's... Yeah, just recent travels I've been doing, just the travel reports I do on my blog all put together into a book. So, no one ever buys them, but it's nice for me to have them as records.
That's awesome. Well, good for you. Well, back in 2020, I actually had you on to talk a bit about British brewing during World War II. And 3 years later, you finally released, it looks like, your book, Blitzkrieg, which is now split into two volumes, I think. Can you tell us about the book?
It's basically about British brewing during World War II, though there's a fair bit about brewing in Holland as well, and some stuff on brewing in Germany. So it's a little bit more than just the UK brewing, but it's mostly focused on that. I had to split it into two because it was too long. It was over 1,000 pages.
My goodness.
And the maximum you can have in Lulu, where I've self-published, is I think 744 pages, so I had to split it into two, and the recipe book is almost the maximum length anyway.
Wow! So what are the two halves then?
So the first half is just the general history stuff, so all the details about brewing techniques, ingredients, what the regulations were, things like that, stuff about the beer styles of the period. And then the second volume, that's just the recipes. So that's got, I can't remember how many, it's a lot. That's why it's so many pages.
And those are actual recipes from various breweries?
Yeah, so these are recipes taken from old brewing records. the thing that I had when I was doing the book was it's like things were so dynamic during the war that if I didn't do a recipe for every beer for every year, then you'd be missing out on a lot of the story of how the beer changed during the year and over the wartime period. So I ended up doing for most of the beers, you know, a recipe from 1939 to 1946 or so. Mm-hmm. So that adds up to a lot of recipes when you're going over quite a few breweries. But I thought it was worthwhile because it's not like they're all the same thing. There's quite a big variation between them from year to year. And I think that's interesting to see because it tells you the story of what brewers were having to cope with during the wartime years and how they were adapting to the circumstances and trying to brew as much beer as they could and as good, the best quality beer that they could under quite difficult circumstances and times.
Well, in the foreword, you sort of have a summary of the overall book, and you talk about the impacts of World War II on beer brewing in Britain. And you summarize it by saying, and I quote, it made beer weaker and more expensive, but at least the pub hours weren't reduced. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, it's true that the price of beer went up a lot. So, for ordinary mild ale, it went up from 4 pence a pint to 12 pence a pint.
Wow.
So it trebled over the wartime years, and it got a good bit weaker as well. So, yeah, you were paying for that. But, I mean, in World War One, there was this massive reduction in the opening times of pubs, and basically they didn't change that during World War Two. In fact, you had often the pubs were compelled to stay open for their permitted hours, even when they didn't have any beer to sell.
Explain that to me. So the government actually regulated the hours that the pubs were open, both in World War One and Two.
Well, all the time they still
all
do.
The time. Okay. Well, what? So, for example, what were the hours during World War Two?
Well, during World War Two, they're basically the sort of hours that I grew up with. So it'd be like from depending on where you were, exactly when the hours were, but it'd be something like 10 in the morning or till 2 in the afternoon, and then 6 in the night till 10:30 or 11 o'clock, something like that. And they were the laws that were brought in the 1922 Licensing Act, which basically formalized the rules that had been brought in piecemeal during World War One. And the biggest thing being afternoon closing, so the pubs having to close for a period of 2 hours during the afternoon.
And what was the purpose behind that? What was the idea behind limiting the hours like that?
Just a load of killjoy temperance people wanted to spoil everyone's fun, basically.
So part of the temperance movement, which of course was big then, right? Temperance movement was quite a significant factor, even during World War One and World War Two, right?
World War One pretty much killed it off in the UK, because what you had happen was that the pub hours were drastically reduced, the strength of beer was drastically reduced, there was far less drunkenness, and it was seen as far less of a social problem. And it really took the wind out of the sails of the temperance movement. And in World War Two, when they started to try and have stuff saying about, as they'd done in World War One, about, oh no, they're making beers destroying food, they were just told to shut up because they were counterproductive to the war effort, and everyone ignored them.
Interesting. So, counter that to here, where, of course, the temperance movement eventually led to prohibition.
And it was moving a similar way in Britain, but just the fact that they made beer so much weaker and the pub hours so much shorter, it sort of half achieved what the temperance people were after, and it sort of, they'd have preferred it to be the old system because that was easier to campaign against. I mean, they always campaigned about people improving pubs.
Interesting.
Because they wanted them to be horrible places.
You have a great chart up in front of the book, too, that shows production during the war. And during the war, production stayed pretty steady, even went up a bit at times. And imports also stayed fairly steady. But what were the driving factors here in production, of course? There's a lot of things going on under the hood, right?
Basically, they wanted to keep beer production up for morale purposes. So what they were aiming to do was to keep at least the same amount of beer being brewed. And in fact, it went up because demand went up when you have things like a whole load of American troops turning up in the UK. You know, you've got a couple of million extra beer drinkers there.
That's true.
It's going to have an impact on the figures. And it wasn't just people from the US. You've got people coming from all over the British Empire as well. So you got a lot of young people in the UK, and a lot of them who'd be wanting to drink beer. So that's one of the reasons beer production went up. And it was quite deliberate. And the government was in total control of the amount of beer being produced and its strength. Basically, it was all based on what brewers had produced in the last full year of peace before the war. That was used as a base, as a benchmark. And so then at various points during the war, they'd say, okay, well, you're allowed to brew 80% of what you brewed before the war, but that's in terms of standard barrels, not bulk barrels. So that would mean you'd have to cut down the strength of the beer, but you could still produce as, you know, but using the same amount of materials, only 80% of the materials you'd use pre-war. And so they had various things like this. I mean, in 1941, the start of that, they made brewers cut their gravities by 10%, next year by another 5%. But then they basically left it alone for the rest of the war. So you see that for from 1942 to 1945, the strength of beer stays pretty much the same. That's because they didn't change the rules about it. And then it actually goes down again after the end of the war. And I think so the I think the lowest points reached in 1947 or 1948. And after that, it starts going up again.
Yeah, I was looking at one of the charts you had, again, at the beginning of the book. So it showed that it dropped from 1.041 down to 1.033, which is a pretty big drop. Now, the government was driving part of that, obviously, but obviously you also had supply problems going on. You had taxes.
It was all completely driven by the government.
Completely driven by the government, huh?
Yeah, they controlled the supply. They gave the brewers licenses to buy either a certain amount of barley if they were malting it themselves or a certain amount of malt. And that was all they were allowed to buy. And they controlled the hop supply the same way. So it wasn't like there was a free market in this stuff. And after 1942, because there'd been a lot of there'd been a big inflation in the price of malting barley in the first couple of years of the war, the government stepped in and took all the supply over and controlled the price, so it didn't go up anymore.
Wow. So, there were still supply shortages going on during the war as well, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, with barley, it's an interesting one because there wasn't a shortage of barley. Barley production shot right up during the war. The reason why they forced brewers to use some flake barley was simply because of a shortage of manpower in the malting industry, and they didn't have the malting capacity. So it was easier and took less energy as well to produce just flake barley. And so they made brewers use 15% of that. They could actually, they had plenty of barley. They could have made the beers all malt, but they didn't have the capacity to malt it.
Interesting. And of course, malting is very energy intensive, right?
Yes. But I thought, oh, it was maybe about the energy. But the determining thing seems to have been the labor.
Interesting. So it wasn't energy. It was actually labor limiting the amount of malting.
Yeah, I'm sure the energy played a part as well. But yeah, so there's all sorts of things that came in. I mean, one of the big ones is the year of oats in 1943, when they'd had a bumper oats crop the year before. So they forced all the brewers to use 15% oats in everything. This is one of the reasons I have recipes for every year, because you have a thing like 1943, where everyone's recipes are completely different, because there's oats in them.
Interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the interwar years and how they affected things. So, for example, talk about critical items like barley. Things never got really completely back to normal in brewing, and it, you know, never got to a free market again, really, after World War I, right? What were some of the things going on during the interwar years between World War I and World War II?
Well, what you see between World War I and World War II is because the amount of beer being brewed in the UK had gone down quite a bit, for the first time Britain in quite a long while, Britain became close to being self-sufficient in brewing materials. Certainly in hops, pretty much 100%. So in barley, they probably could have been, apart from the fact that they like using North American barley for various reasons, partly about the enzymes and partly about the nitrogen content. But they probably could have actually been self-sufficient in it in the interwar periods, just because the demand had shrunk so much in the UK after World War One. And so that made recipes look a bit different. You don't have loads of American hops in beers anymore. You mostly see English varieties, some continental ones, and the odd American hop, but nothing like before World War One, where, you know, you might have seen 25% or 30% of the hops in beer coming from the US.
If I recall, in the 1800s, New York was producing a huge amount of hops, right, and exporting it overseas until they hit the blight, right?
Yeah, and then when you see that happen, then the industry moves over to the West Coast, and then Britain just starts importing the hops from there. Hmm. And so then you see all these things turning up in California, Washington, Oregon, those names turning up in the brewing records when you see that the industry's moved.
Interesting.
And you can tell in the brewing records which it is, because when they're the East Coast hops, they just call them American. And when they're the West Coast hops, they call them either Pacifics or a specific state or something like that. So you can tell where they came from.
Now, in the interwar years, obviously during World War One, things were very limited as well. In the interwar years, was there something like a free market going on in beer making or not?
Yeah. I mean, the last price restrictions ended, I think, 1921 or 1922. And so there was a free market then. But what you had happen was that basically the beer styles were frozen by the last set of price restrictions.
Explain that to me. I don't understand.
So at the end of World War One and just after it, you had restrictions on these price restrictions. So beers of certain gravities would cost a certain price. So something that was 10.30 to 10.34 would cost 5p a pint. Mm-hmm. Something that cost 10.54 would cost 9p a pint.
So the price of the actual product was fixed, I guess? The beer prices were fixed?
This is the retail price. The wholesale prices weren't fixed, interestingly enough, but the retail prices were. This is the retail price per pint in a public bar.
Wow.
It was very specific. But you had all these gravity bands and the prices that went from 4p a pint to 8p or 9p a pint. And then after the war, you see that all the brewers, especially in London, stick to those gravity bands and those prices.
And the government wasn't enforcing them at that point, or no?
No, but it was just that's what the tax level was, and that's how much you'd have to charge for beers of that strength.
Huh.
But one of the things it had was, one of the weird effects was it had a capping effect, because the top band didn't have any upper limit. So it was anything over 10.54 or 10.55, I can't remember, cost 8p a pint. So it was made no economic sense to brew anything much stronger than that.
So you wouldn't be making like a barley wine or an imperial stout or something like that.
Huh? Yeah, this is for draft beers. So you see that after the war, virtually no one brews a draft beer over about 10.55, which is the start of the last tax band.
Hmm.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, probably no reason to do it then, huh?
No, but it's odd the way it gets fixed. And because the prices didn't change in the interwar period, then it really was the price of a pint of mild stayed the same from 1922 to 1940.
Wow. And of course, once World War II started, the government stepped in almost immediately and started limiting and rationing everything, right?
Yes, well, they assumed something had happened like in World War One. Yeah, you have to remember, this was very fresh in everyone's mind in World War II. It was only 20 years before.
Right.
So people could remember the U-boat campaign and the effect that had on food supply. And so people realized, well, yes, that we can't depend too much on imported food. We're going to have to grow as much stuff as we can in the country and try and limit imports as much as possible.
And then, of course, this drove brewers to look for alternatives to barley. What were some of the substitutions they made? Some of them were obviously, as you mentioned, oats was driven by the government.
Yeah, well, most of them were usually driven by the government. I mean, the government also toyed with the idea of using potato starch.
Interesting.
And there were experiments. It just tasted awful. And so that's why that didn't get any further. I mean, what I said before is that before World War II, flaked maize was incredibly popular. Most brewers used it. Most brewers threw some into pretty much everything they brewed. There wasn't any maize grown in, well, corn, as you call it, in the UK, grown in the UK at that time. It was all imported. So you see, that gets completely cut out of recipes. And instead, people go over using flake barley, which is what the government told them to. And then that goes on all the way through the war and to a couple of years after. Imports of hops come to a complete standstill, except there's a little bit of an experiment right at the end of the war with bringing in some sort of hop concentrate from the States. But yeah, mostly they were just brewing the beers weaker. Sugar was the big thing, that the amount of sugar was reduced. So brewers were only allowed about 2/3 of the amount of sugar that they'd used before the war. So that meant they had to change their recipe. So oddly, to some people's eyes, the recipes had actually looked better because the malt percentage often goes up during the war, mostly because of the reduction in the sugar content.
And obviously, we got shortages in raw materials, we've got shortages in energy, and as you mentioned, massive shortages in manpower as well. I assume that drove the prices up pretty rapidly, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you see, it goes up every year. But, I mean, the biggest thing would be the tax, would be driving the price increases as much as anything. So, admittedly, in the first couple of years of the war, the increase in the price of barley probably had quite a big effect as well. Interestingly, they didn't have price controls like they had in World War One.
So I assume that means the price of the beer continues to go up as the war goes on, right?
Yes, as the tax goes up and as the price of materials go up, yes. But, I mean, you have to realize that because such a big percentage of the price of beer was taxed, you know, you're looking at like maybe 50% of the retail price, that a 10% increase in tax has a way bigger influence than a 10% increase in the price of the raw materials.
Right, right. How did taxes go during, obviously they went up, but how rapidly did taxes rise during that period?
I haven't got that to hand, actually. Actually, I've got that one. A load. They always do during the wars. I think it went up about 5 or 10-fold. I'm sure I can find this.
And if I remember right, the taxes are usually based on original gravity, right?
Yes, that's how it always was.
Look. You don't have to look it up right this second.
You're just saying that was
driving the prices a lot, right?
Okay, so 1939, it was 80 shillings a standard barrel, which is a complicated tax thing, which I don't want to try and explain at this
moment. No, it's, even today they use some kind of alcohol by volume that's not actually alcohol by volume to tax, I think, in Britain.
No, it is out by ABV now. They changed it in the 90s.
But they use their own formula, which I always found interesting. In fact, I've had people write me and ask me if I could incorporate that into the software because it's not the standard formula. But
okay, so it went up by about 350% from 80 shillings a barrel to 364 shillings a barrel.
And you mentioned the price of beer went up almost 300% too, I think, right? So pretty close correlation there.
Yeah, so the tax went up from 2 pence a pint to 9 pence a pint for an average strength beer.
Wow. And are the brewers trying to do anything to keep the price down, or are they just letting it go as well? Because I assume the prices of everything are rising.
Well, the thing is that it sort of takes a lot of that out of the equation, because if such a high percentage of it is the tax, then any economies of scale you make aren't necessarily that effective.
Right.
The big brewers did get an advantage is that in the system, you're allowed 6% waste. So up to 6% of the beer, when it went into fermentation, you didn't have to pay tax on. So if your waste was less than that, you got free beer or tax-free beer. And what it also encouraged brewers to do was to recycle ullage and all sorts of other crap that was in the brewery, because that was tax-free as well.
Interesting.
So ullage being returned beer.
So, I mean, the whole beer production was almost nationalized at this point, right? I mean, there's no free market, really.
More than there was in World War One.
I guess technically the breweries aren't owned by the government, but they're certainly being managed and controlled by the government.
Well, yes, they were told how much they could brew.
Yeah.
And they were allocated raw materials, but that was much the same as any other industry at the time. That because there was a shortage of resources generally, they were allocated on the basis of where they were going to be the most effective.
Right.
And so the brewing industry was just subject to the same controls as everyone else.
Interesting. But I mean, it would be very difficult, for example, to open a new brewery during this period, I would think, right?
Well, yes, because they were allocated on, the raw materials were allocated on how much you'd used in the year before the war. So if you hadn't existed then, you got no allocation of materials.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what, that was my point.
Well, that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why you see not many breweries of any size closed during the war, because if they're owned, especially if they're owned by someone else, it's like, there's a good example, the Highgate Brewery in Walsall, a fairly small brewery, was owned by a larger one, Mitchell and Butlers. They were going to close it in 1940, but they didn't because they didn't want to lose the allocation of the raw materials. And so they kept it open. Hmm. And so I'm sure that happened in lots of other cases. And even though the number of breweries went down, and I do have the figures from this, from 885 in 1935 to 708 in 1945, I'm pretty sure that most of those ones that closed were probably pub breweries.
Probably what? I'm sorry?
Well, just brew pubs.
Oh, just brew pubs. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would imagine it's difficult. And then, can you talk a little bit about the manpower shortages?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's why you get a lot more women moving into industries than you saw beforehand. Though, interestingly, in the brewing industry, I haven't heard anything about them actually moving into the brewing side. It seems to be that women were still limited in brewing pretty much to just the bottling department.
Hmm.
Bottling department and maybe secretarial work in the office. And that'd be the only women you'd have in breweries, even during wartime, it seems.
Interesting. Well, in the book, you go style by style and talk about each style. So let's talk, and I know you have recipes in many cases for every style as well, and talk about how those changed during the war. But can you talk about perhaps a few of the styles and dive into how you see them evolving during the war?
Well, basically, you see them getting weaker. I mean, one of the things you see with mild is that you see it becoming, in some cases, darker, which is probably an attempt to try and hide the fact that it's got weaker. And that's generally a trend that you see, that after World War II, mild is normally a darker shade than it had been before World War II. So you didn't have that many out-and-out really dark milds before the war in London and a few other areas. But a lot of them, in a lot of places, the milds weren't completely dark. They were sort of like half-dark. And after the war, they've really mostly gone either dark or properly pale. So, I mean, that's a trend that you see. Stouts is an interesting one. And this is where you have an interesting split between London stouts and Irish stouts, is what happens to them over the period of the war. So they start off in a similar place with about 75% attenuation. And what you see after the war is that things like Guinness go for a much higher degree of attenuation than they had before, and the London stouts go the opposite way, and they have a lower degree of attenuation. And so they become sweeter and more full-bodied. And it looks like they went for different options, and that the London brewers wanted to try and keep some body in their beer, and that's why they dropped the degree of attenuation to keep them fuller tasting. But that's my guess.
Interesting. What is going on in Ireland during this time? I saw, you know, there was a note at the beginning of the book talking about how Ireland continued to import a lot of beer into Britain.
Well, but you said earlier that the imports stayed about the same. Well, you have to realize that the imports of beer into Britain before the war were 95% Guinness.
So that's what I was wondering. Yeah. So it sounded like they're still producing a lot of beer in Ireland and still shipping Guinness over to Britain.
Well, right? Yes, you had a whole conflict between Britain and Ireland over Guinness during the war.
Interesting. Can you talk about that? The Guinness beer war?
Well, yeah. So you had this thing, I can't remember what year it was, I think it's about 1942, 1943, where the Irish wanted to get more supplies of bread making grains, so stuff like wheat, mm-hmm. from the UK, because they didn't have enough of their own. And they basically said that unless you give us the amount of grain we want, we're not going to export any beer anymore. And this was like a huge problem for Northern Ireland, where virtually all of their beer came from the Irish Republic.
Yeah.
And so they were, this was a massive problem if they couldn't get any of this beer. It would mean they'd only have like 10% of the normal beer supplies. They couldn't possibly be replaced from the UK because they just didn't have any spare beer and they wouldn't want to ship it over the Irish Sea anyway. And so the British government eventually had to give in.
And basically agree
to give the Irish the grains they wanted because they didn't really have much of an option.
Well, so no grains, Ireland, no Guinness, huh?
Yeah. it's a very interesting little interlude.
Interesting. So what are some of the other styles that are changing and evolving during this period?
Well, you're seeing brown ales getting weaker as everything else. All the bottled beers struggled during the war because they had, I mean, for various reasons. One, they had shortages of everything, so they didn't have glass to make new bottles. So you see all these things during the war where I've got the stuff from Barclay Perkins, the letters they sent out to their publicans, and there's always these warnings saying if you don't send back the bottles, empty bottles, you won't get any more new ones, and things like that. And yeah, basically begging them to always send back all the bottles and crates and even things like the crown corks so they could reuse them.
That makes sense. I assume during the war there's shortages of everything probably, right?
Yeah, well, the crown corks got metal in it. So this really affected bottled beer styles because it made it more difficult for breweries to produce them because they had a limited number of bottles. And also because they were more expensive and labor intensive, it was generally discouraged. So there was a move to more draft beer during the war.
So I assume they're serving more out of kegs, right?
Yeah, so it'd be more draft beer because it's something that uses less labor and less energy than bottling. It's the most efficient way to do it.
Now, did the beer preferences change over this time? So I assume you got, like you said, millions of Americans camping out waiting for D-Day. You've got people coming from all over the empire. Did that change the consumption patterns of certain styles of beer?
Not that I've really noticed from the brewing records, but
maybe because they were, that each of the brewers was being limited in what they could produce, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like people weren't going to start suddenly brewing lager because they didn't have the equipment to do it, and they wouldn't have had the right malt or anything. So people just carried on brewing the same styles. Mostly, it was just a shift more to draft beer during the war. And people were generally just happy to drink whatever they could get hold of. This is what you find. People didn't complain too much about the quality of the beer during the war because they were just happy they'd got something to drink.
Interesting. Now let's move just a little bit into the post-war period. So World War II ends. Do the restrictions get lifted right away or not?
No, you see them lasting for, I think it's like about, I think it's only about 50, 51, where they lift the restrictions on gravity.
So another 4 years, I guess, or more, yeah.
Yeah, a bit more than that. But, I mean, the post-war years were very difficult in Britain. I mean, harder than the war years, which a lot of people don't realise. And, rationing went on till well into the 1950s. So it's not like things have returned back to normal immediately. And what you see in the early 50s, when the restrictions do lift, that's when, in London especially, you see a new set of beers appearing, which are things like what Fuller's originally called Special Pale Ale, which is London Pride, and beers like Young Special, which is strong bitters, which people hadn't brewed for quite a long while. And so what had been their pale ales from before the war had fallen down to just being like 3.7% alcohol. And so they introduced new beers, which were stronger, rather than putting the old beers back to a higher strength. So they introduced these special bitters, and you get a whole load of the breweries that did this, things that are like, sort of 4% ABV. So stronger than the bitters people have been used to for quite a long while, since back before the war.
So they're basically reintroducing beers that they actually did probably brew before the war, but just putting it under a new brand name then, huh?
Yeah, so it was a new brand, but obviously these beers wouldn't be selling as much as the ordinary bitters. So this was now a special beer rather than being the standard beer as it had been before the war.
And did the beer preferences change again after the war, and once the restrictions were lifted, or not?
Well, yeah, then you see a big swing towards bottled beer. So I think at some points in the 50s, it gets up to being like 35% of consumption, which you have to realize when 85% of the beer is being drunk in pubs. That means a lot of people were drinking bottled beer in pubs. It's not just people drinking more at home.
Mm-hmm.
So and a lot of that's to do with people not being very happy with the quality of cask beer. And so what people would do is that they'd mix a half of mild with a bottle of brown ale, or a half of bitter with a bottle of light ale, because they couldn't really afford to drink all bottled beer. But if they, you know, if it was a bit of a not particularly well-conditioned draft beer, they could liven it up with some bottled beer.
So were there problems with the draft beer, just the way it was being served, or what?
Oh, well, it's partly a result of the strengths going down again. So you got beer that's only, you know, most of the beer was only 3% alcohol. And so you have to be quite careful with that. It's quite easy to completely mess it up. You know, a stronger beer is a bit more robust. They had the same problem after World War One, when the beer strengths had gone down, that, you know, landlords had been fairly lazy and they hadn't had to take too much care when the beer had been 5 or 5.5% ABV. But when it was only, you know, 3 or 4%, then they had to take a bit more care of it. And the same thing happened after World War Two, because the strength went down again. And yeah, people who weren't happy about it, they'd either drink all bottled beer or drink mixed. And then you see what you see then is you see keg beer comes along, being basically a something like bottled beer but sold in bulk, and so you have people who aren't very happy with the cask beer who might drink the keg beer because it's nice and bright, fizzy, and isn't cloudy and sour.
Interesting. And I assume, we see a big fall off eventually of the cask beer, right?
Yes. I mean, that's what you see when you get to the 60s and the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Was there a consolidation of breweries after the war? It sounds like the restrictions were in place for quite a long time, but after that, did things consolidate like they did in the U.S. or no?
Yeah, well, what you had was that there were also restrictions not just on beer strengths and stuff like that. There are also restrictions on building works and investing in equipment and stuff like that. So breweries weren't really free to invest again until the early 1950s.
Uh-huh.
And so what you had was, because no one could invest during the war, and then a lot of people had no money during the 1920s and 1930s, there were lots of breweries where the last serious investments had been before World War One. So you got these breweries that were 50 years old and starting to fall apart in some cases. And so what you find in quite a few breweries who stopped brewing just because some piece of equipment had failed and they had neither the money or the inclination to replace it, and so they just sold up instead.
So there was a consolidation then, and I assume some investment in new equipment, obviously, because after 50 years.
Yeah, and so it was caused partly just by breweries that were knackered, and that was some of that was due to the war and the aftermath of the war, why breweries were in that state.
Well, not and only so, that, two yeah. wars, right? You have yeah. two wars and the Depression in between, right?
Yeah, so it hadn't been good to a lot of companies. And so, yeah, there are a lot of very, very old breweries knocking around. And, yeah, where the owners might be the fourth or fifth generation and who didn't really have any interest in the brewery anymore, and they just wanted to get their money.
What styles dominated the post-World War II era in Britain?
I'd say mild ale, brown ale, and milk stout.
So mild ale, I think we've talked about before, was sort of the working man's drink, right?
Yeah, that was still the most popular drink. I mean, during the 40s and 50s, that was like about probably half of the beer brewed.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned the other two. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, so brown ale, that was a big thing during the 50s. A lot of that would be, like I said before, people who weren't, you know, mix it with mild. So it was a very popular type of bottled beer. Milk stout was incredibly popular. I mean, Whitbread stole huge quantities of it in the form of Mackeson. I think it was something like 25% of what they brewed or something stupid.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So they would, to talk of things which aren't really popular now, but what you find is as people are getting better off, then you get people moving from mild to bitter because it's seen as, you know, if you've got a bit more cash in your pocket, then you can afford to buy the slightly fancier drink.
I think you mentioned, yeah, bitter was like served on one side of the bar and the mild was served on the other or something.
That had been the case in the past. If you looked in the 30s, yes, that the saloon bar or the lounge bar, the more expensive side, that would mostly be selling bitter, and the public bar would mostly be selling mild. But after the war, you'd see that, yeah, there'd probably be quite a lot of people in the public bar that would be drinking mild bitter as well.
So going back to World War II, would you, if I sampled a beer at the beginning of the war and then sampled it several times, pick your favorite style, sampled it several times during the middle, can you talk about how maybe one example changed?
Well, if you're looking at Bartley Perkins' main mild ale,
okay,
you know, at the start of the war, that wasn't completely dark. It was about 4.2% alcohol, 4.3, reasonably well hopped. So yeah, quite a nice beer. By the end of the war, it was 2.7% ABV, a bit darker, wow. not very well hopped. Yeah, I mean, I've actually had a version of the 1945 one, Pretty Things brewed a few years back, and it was. Yeah, quite thin.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's talk about your book. Where can people purchase your book and also learn more a little bit about the history of British brewing?
They can learn more about British brewing at my blog, which is barclayperkins.blogspot.com. I think mm-hmm. that's what it is.
Yeah, that's right.
Shut up about Barclay Perkins if you want to search for it. And there you can find links to buying my many books. My one about World War II, you can get there. It's called Blitzkrieg. It's available on Lulu. And there are two volumes. You don't have to buy both of them. It's one of the reasons I've split it into two is I realize some people might not want to buy 600 recipes if they're not home brewers. So, yeah, so both volumes are available there, plus my many other wonderful books on beer history, including Stout, which is all about London Stout, and one on Billiton and Weisse, all sorts of interesting things I've written books on.
Well, Ron, we've done a couple episodes on this, but can you sort of summarize the whole thread through here from, World War I, the interwar years into World War II, and then, of course, we get into the post-war years. How did that all of that whole period affect British brewing?
Well, pretty monumentally. You see that the beers that are, you look at the range of beers a brewery was producing in 1914 and compare it to the ones they were producing in 1950, it would be pretty different.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't just be the strengths. Something like brown ale didn't exist really in 1914. Only a couple of breweries made it. Something like, yeah, I suppose light ale sort of did. The type of stouts people were brewing were completely different. You had draft stouts for a start, which in most places you wouldn't have in 1950. So pretty huge changes. Mild would go from being something of 5% to being something of 3%. I sometimes think it's odd if you were someone who was 18 in 1914 and started drinking then, what it would be like, you know, the next 50 years of drinking probably be quite depressing as the beer kept getting weaker and weaker.
And Ron, your summary, you've probably studied this subject more than anybody else on the planet, I think, but your summary of brewing, British brewing in World War II, and your closing thoughts, please.
I think British brewing did remarkably well to keep up beer outputs and to keep brewing beer of a reasonable quality under fairly difficult circumstances. So I think it was a big success for British brewing that, you know, there was enough beer for everyone. And it didn't have to get incredibly weak. And if you compare it to what brewing was like in most other countries, Britain did amazingly well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron, it's a pleasure to have you on the show again today. Thank you for coming on.
Okay, my pleasure. Always fun to have a chat.
Again, my guest today was Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical brewing, and he runs a blog at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Thanks once again, Ron.
My pleasure.
A big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click on those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support our show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.